Hello and welcome to Happy Place with me, Fern Cotton. I've got an unbelievable treat for you this week. I'm chatting to Hanson.
We're not the same at all, and we've changed in every way except for the way you perceive us. I mean, yeah, we're still making music, but you're just not making it in the same way you did 25 years ago. There's a spirit that's the same, but your skills are different. The way you write is different. The amount of time you have to do it, what you want from your day and your life and your music is different.
That voice belongs to Zach Hanson. He and older brothers, Isaac and Taylor, have been making music for 30 years. Absolute madness. And now they're back with a new album, Red, Green, Blue. Now, we share a similar career trajectory in the fact that we were all in the public eye since we were children. But what I was really interested in is the fact that, to me at least, it seems that these guys have coped incredibly well with fame over a prolonged period of time. As someone who at times was very guided by other people's opinion of me, especially when I was younger, I was so fascinated to talk to them about how and why they don't allow outside opinion to fundamentally shake their sense of self. I also, by the way, absolutely love the way they talk about each other and the roles they play in the band and in life. This chat is filled with the sort of insight that only comes from knowing people as intimately as siblings do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
As many people will know from either listening to me back in the day on radio, or if you listen to my Sounds of the 90s radio show now, I was a mega Hanson fan when I was a teenager. So when I was chatting to Hanson, the 14-year-old in me was quite active, like freaking out at times, and the 40-year-old self kept it professional, people. The thing I love about Happy Place is that we can interview Deepak Chopra and Hanson, and it happened. Let's listen to this raucous chat. Here's the show. Hello, Hanson. How are you?
Good.
Hello, we're pretty
great.
Good.
Very good. Good to see you.
Yeah, you too.
So I hear you and all the things we do on podcasts.
Absolutely. So are you at home today? Where are you?
We're in Tulsa. Yeah, we're in Oklahoma. We're
at the studio.
At the studio. Yeah. Not actually in our respective homes, but in our studio.
And I sort of feel like the studio is a home, you know?
Yes, home away from home.
I've been trying to put bunks in the studio for years. They won't let me.
Yeah, but this
is you need to have a bed there for sure.
It's a home I want a vacation from, you know?
Right.
I'm like, please.
You're in there way too much. And what time of day is it there? I'm at 3 p.m. this end. Where are you?
It's the morning. It's 9 a.m. here.
Yeah. So you've got your coffees. Okay,
yeah,
good.
Things are starting, but, you know, all of us have kids, so we've been up for a while.
Well, quite. We're going to get onto that subject in a bit. But I've spoke to you, I think, maybe 2 years ago now, and it's been a strange sort of time vortex over the last couple of years. So sort of lots has happened and nothing has happened, but we've got lots and lots to catch up on. But so you're now in your 30th year as a band, am I right?
That's right. Well, we're technically this year, you know, 2022 is the year that we hit 30.
Yeah, we're a few weeks away from hitting the anniversary not only of our first major release, Middle of Nowhere, which happened in May, but also our first proper half-hour gig that we did a cappella. And it was something like May 14th or 15th in 1992. So it just happened that our first major release and when we started performing as a band were in the same month. So kind of worked out.
Yes, we're old. Yep.
Well, this is it. Like, I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm of a similar age to you all. Mm-hmm. And and I just, I sometimes go, how is that, how can I be 40? That's actually not possible. Yeah. And how have 30 years passed? And it's just, it's a cliche, but it has sort of just terrifyingly flown.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's true. It's true. I mean, of course, maybe that's what people always feel. I don't know. But I do feel like our generation, I mean, the lines of age have definitely changed.
I think
because for one, in I don't think not in a good way. I think people are almost too obsessed with youth. Like you should just be where you are. But we've also had, like a lot of the rites of passage, have faded in our generation of like, this mm-hmm. is what's going to happen. You're going to go. Things that our grandparents used to do that, you're going to actually have a suit that you're going to have to actually wear somewhere. Like people don't mm-hmm. even put suits on, even in boardrooms.
Except for me, it's just all in black, though.
Things are very, like the layers, I feel like, of getting older, like the milestones have all kind of blurred away.
I agree.
I don't feel particularly old. I'm 36. But when I think about it for a minute, I'm like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
I look down at my 9-year-old and I'm like, he thinks I'm old. Like
yes.
he thinks he thinks about me the way I think about my dad, which is my dad was never young.
You know,
like my dad is always old.
Like he had a mustache.
Crap.
Always.
I know. I sometimes think I feel about, I don't know, 19 maybe. That's how I sort of feel. Yeah. And I go, what would 40 feel like? What's that meant to feel like? Because I don't feel it. I'm not there. Mm.
Yeah,
yeah, but when I'm around 19-year-olds,
yes, that's when you feel 40.
I don't want to be 19.
You're like,
I feel full of youth and vigor and humor, and
like,
you're
and
then around 19-year-olds, I'm like, you know nothing.
I know. I have a 20-year-old stepson, and I'm just obviously the like most seriously uncool person. I feel unbelievably old around him and his friends, and it's so strange. There was a weird sort of phenomenon I experienced when I was researching for this chat today, watching some video clips of you guys and interviews mm-hmm. and whatnot. And every single, they were all American, I think, but every single American TV host that introduced you said the line, and here they are, all grown up, like there is an alternative that you might still be 15.
Yeah. Oh, and you can't just throw the U.S. under the bus on that one because that's a global phenomenon.
I'm sure it is. Like, what are people wanting you to turn up as teenagers? I don't understand. It's very peculiar.
Well, you might have had some similar things along
yes.
the way too, because you've been doing radio since you were a young person, and like
yes.
there's a degree
and
to
TV,
which
doing it a lot.
Yeah, TV yeah. exactly, all of it. So it's like, so when you start off that young, I guess people just have that imprinted in their mind, and that's okay. But it is weird to have every record since Middle of Nowhere be reviewed as it's quite mature.
Yeah, like,
you know,
what
it's,
the hell?
It's evolving into a very mature album. You're like, wait, I'm sorry, what?
It's kind of hilarious. Sorry, I'm just thinking about what you just said. To think about people imagining you showing up at 12,
still.
20 years later.
Yeah.
But they're like, hey, it's Hanson, but I want to preface it real quick. They're grown up.
Yeah. We better point that out because people might not
as
spot
well
that.
For them.
I know, but you know what? When you're in your sort of 60s and 70s, you're going to love that one. You will be clinging on to that one for dear life. Yeah, you're going to be absolutely loving
it. It's the fact that everybody is narcissistic. We're all obsessed with where we are.
Yeah.
And so we just think of everyone else. We need to relate them to our experiences. And that's, that's, I think, what it is that wherever you go, people just want to go like, okay, now I'm going to frame you around me.
Or it's a little bit like having a family reunion every single time you go on a TV show. Oh, man, you were this big last time I saw
yes.
you.
Yeah, but I was 28 then.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, the last time.
Oh, it's just bizarre. It's brilliantly bizarre. So look, as we've established, you started the band at a very young age. I was 15 when I started doing TV stuff. You guys are like, what, 9, 10, 12? You know, super, super
yeah,
young.
Yeah.
What incentivized you to pick up instruments in the first place? What was the reason?
Well, I mean, there's the true story, and then there's the lie version. Let's see which one. No,
okay. True. We only do truth on Happy Place.
Yeah,
okay. Only.
Truth.
No, yeah.
Truth.
So, I mean, we heard rock and roll. I mean, we were, for one, musical family. Nobody had a career officially paying the bills with music, but both of our parents were super musical. And then we had this strange thing where our dad took a job nobody wanted, which was to let go be an accountant in Latin America, kind of auditing operations for a company there that he worked for. And he took four children with him and his wife. And we were in this for a year plus. We were very isolated from a lot of things, but we had a little sampling of rock and roll. We had a collection of songs from 1958. It was like our little American slice. And as young kids, we just sort of obsessively listened to these.
Also, let me translate this for anyone that is listening that is not, you know, our age. It would be like having a playlist.
Yes.
A song.
Yeah, a
specifically
playlist. A tape.
You made know. From 1958.
But only one playlist.
Yeah. Only one playlist. So you could only listen to one playlist.
Isaac and I are, you know, really Zach is, you know, basically an infant at that point. But Isaac and I were young, you know, kids. And you're in this isolated situation, you know, internationally. And you kind of have some natural musical inclinations, but all of a sudden you have this exposure to Chuck Berry, Otis Redding. You know, actually, Otis Redding wasn't on that, but you know,
Little Richard.
Early, you know, songs like Rockin' Robin and Splish Splash and Good Golly Miss Molly and rock and roll at its core. And when we came back, as still very, very young, all of a sudden that was ingrained in our psyche. And this is totally of another generation, right? This is the late 50s when we're in the late 80s, right? Early 90s.
It wasn't listening to our parents' old tapes. It would be like listening to their much older siblings.
Yeah.
Like tapes and records, or even maybe almost their parents, but not quite.
And so we just, you know, I remember distinctly, I mean, this is, I can just hear harmony. I mean, all of us hear harmony, but I just remember it being 6 years old and hearing Isaac was singing along to Chuck Berry. And I just hear harmony. I mean, you can't, it's like, that's a door and that's a harmony, you know? And so.
And I can attest to that I was always surprised how quickly and how easily you hear. Yeah. That has always been a unique gift that Taylor has.
Well, and it's one of those just, it's like, okay, there it is. Then you decide do you want to do it? Do you want to learn? Do you want to become get a craft? And we all started taking piano lessons. We did the classical piano thing. And it just snowballed from there. I mean, I like to say, you know, one of the things that happened was we realized that people, every time we would do it, we'd just sort of stand up and sing because somebody would say, hey, don't you guys sing? Oh, you're so cute. And every time you do something that you get a good reaction, it's like Pavlov's dogs, like you want to do it again. You know, wow, yeah. People clap and smile and they give me, you know.
And they gave me treats.
And so it just builds from there. And then you start to identify like, wow, like this actually is something people do. And then you see, for me, it was Michael Jackson. You know, and going, oh my God, like that. What is that? And so,
well, Michael Jackson with his brothers as the Jackson Five, also
exactly,
specifically.
Just the energy of
like realizing, wait a second, it's not just a crazy dream. There's actually people that have started off very young at my age, basically, right? And now is one of the biggest artists in the world that can happen.
And the intensity of it, not just literally like fame and stardom, but that, wow, like there's something magnetic happening in this song and this rhythm. And Zach famously rejected one of our neighbors that didn't know who the Jackson 5 were when we were kids, like sitting. And of course, this is this early 90s, these kids, of course, they don't know this stuff. And we're talking about this and that. And Zach at maybe like 7, and he said, Jackson 5, who's that? And Zach said, you need to leave.
Come back when you know who the Jackson 5 are.
So I love that.
You know, there's so many layers to music. Obviously, people, you know, more and more I'm convinced humans are musical. Everyone is musical, right? We're actually, we don't all have the same set of tools. But the reason people love music is because everyone kind of feels like they know how to do it at a primal level.
Well, because on its most basic level, even just rhythm is something that people can respond to and understand.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have a great, you know, melodic sense or ability to sing, you can respond to the rhythm that is happening and understand that. So.
Yeah, and especially kids. And, I see it in my own children, but it's remarkable that you felt all of those things and you recognized that it made you feel a certain way. But you also combined that with going, and we could give that a go and we could make this happen. And, you know, I'm sure it's probably similar to when I started out TV presenting. You do have this sort of wonderful naivety that you go, yes, anything is possible. And I don't have that as much now at the age of 40, but certainly as kids, if you're lucky enough to be brought up in a household where you're, you know, either encouraged or I wasn't particularly encouraged, but I was sort of left to my own devices.
Yeah,
you're given the freedom to go, yeah, I could do that and I'm going to give it a go. And, you know, not only did you have that thought, but you started to then action it to to enable it to happen.
Well, I think that that's something that I would say to any parent, which is, look, you don't have to necessarily be the facilitator, but don't actively become the discourager.
Yeah.
You know, like your kids will show certain, you know, innate kind of abilities, which in many cases will probably be an amalgam of things that are like you and like your spouse, and like they'll be picking up on either through nurture or nature, which it's probably a lot nature in a lot of cases. But you have that element of, okay, well, just don't screw it up. You know, like, you know, you don't have to necessarily like put an afterburner on the rocket, but you know, you can at least let it be. And we had that advantage of parents who were actually a little bit probably closer to the afterburner than anything. They were mom was willing to, when we said crazy things out loud, mom was willing to go, well, that might be possible. I love that.
But that's so brilliant, because I think, you know, so many people that have wanted to do something, whether it's in the arts or something that doesn't fit into the very linear education system, are discouraged because it's not seen as a viable route to any kind of opportunity or success. But as you said, you know, you had that experience in family life, and that led you to, as you said earlier, perform in different guises wherever you were. And one of those seminal moments being at the South by Southwest Festival, where you then met your manager at the time, and then it seemed to sort of just snowball from there for you guys. And it was then this international whirlwind of you know, you were a band at that point, and you were professionally working as children and traveling the world. And I wonder how you took to that, because that's a monumental gear change to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, a million different layers to it. But it did, I mean, absolutely, like, exponentially sped up. But in that moment, you think it's moving so slow. You're going, well, but, you know, it's actually, you look back and you go, wow, went from here to here. But yeah,
The days are long and the years are short,
Definitely. The days are long and the years are very short. And I do think that that's true with career path like that one. But I would just quick rewind, you know, something slightly broader is, I do think that, you know, there's so much possibility now around, especially the generation coming up, that one of the things, I don't think people hear this enough, it's not just for like something as rare and strange as succeeding in music, which is like 2% success rate or something crazy, if that, you know, if people even
2% sounds like a
even
lot.
Even recouping the cost of making records and then, you know, having a career. So we're very, very, very lucky and blessed to do it. But, you know, anything, I don't think they hear enough, like, it's going to be hard. You know,
yeah.
I think people need to know, like, if you, whatever path, like, it's going to take that toughness to just, not that it should be painful, but meaning, like, you're going to have to work at stuff. You're going to have to try. You're going to have to hear no a lot. And that's okay. Like, that's actually more than likely what happens when you're on most paths. Even if you just decide, you know, hey, I want to be a doctor. Being a doctor is incredibly difficult. Being an attorney is different. I mean, running a business, whatever version you take.
Running a bakery or anything.
I mean, I would not want to be, being an exceptional plumber is not easy.
No.
I mean, people that have whatever path you're on, you're going to hear a lot of like uphill climbing. And I think we had this strange combination. It's still true of our parents. They're totally opposite. My dad is all work ethic. And, you know, he's a big heart, show up and work and get, you know, do the hard work. Very masochistic. Has to feel the pain. And my
pain.
Mom is like, do not say something to her that you don't want her to try and help you do. Like, warning. Like, there should be a warning. Like, do not speak to this woman about anything you don't want to sort of actualize.
Our wives had to learn that the hard
way. She will show up with the, you're like, wait, I wasn't thinking, like, actually move the pool, like, tomorrow. No, like, let's go 10 feet that direction. Here's the crane, you know.
Oh, she sounds amazing.
She is amazing. What? She's, but it's the thing of, like, they, you know, you can't tell her something you don't want to do, and you can't tell him something you don't want to work at. The combination of that is like you standing in the middle going,
all possible and you can do it with enough work.
Yeah.
But what, I guess it's interesting because, you know, when does that even end? It's not like you guys released that first album and went, cool, we're done. We've done that now. You know, we climbed the ladder to success and we've had it. It's, you know, the hard work then, I think, really kicks in because you want to stay in it or you want to grow within it. You know, I had a sort of career change of sorts about 5 years ago and sort of almost started again with building something new. And I think, you know, that's also, people don't necessarily want to hear that, I guess, at the start of a career, is that you don't ever reach a final, this pinnacle, mm-hmm. this moment of, and then I felt complete because I was successful or I reached this milestone, because then you'll just find another one or some, or you feel uncomfortable in that or whatever. So I guess it's kind of, you know, I'm very fortunate. I love my job. I get to do it every day. You're very fortunate. You get to make music and that's your job. But like you say, there has to be an element of hard work within that, that structure of luck and fortune or, you know, or fate, whatever else steps in to get you to that place.
So much work, so much commitment.
Well, I mean, I think the place where people really stumble and fail is that they assume because they're doing the same thing, it is the same thing, right? Inevitably. Like, people will talk about our dynamic. They go, how have you stayed together? How have you guys kept, you know, it good for so long? And I'm like, it's because we're not the same at all. And we've changed in every way except for the way you perceive us. I mean, yeah, we're still making music, but you're just not making it in the same way you did 25 years ago. And there's a spirit that's the same, but your skills are different. The way you write is different. The amount of time you have to do it, what you want from your day and your life and your music is different. I mean, when we were, you know, I was 12. I mean, I was writing songs about frogs. I'm still writing songs about frogs.
Good.
But
frogs are right.
The frogs are much more complex, you know?
Like, right.
They turn into a prince and then they let the princess down and then they won't take out the garbage.
Yeah, I hear you. But it is so interesting because, you know, I'm sure you can all look back at the strangeness of what you get exposed to within, you know, well, just being in the public eye, but certainly traveling internationally and going on TV shows or all the bits that you don't necessarily expect when you're starting out in music specifically, and the relentless commentary that you are exposed to. That's the nature of it, that people will always have commentary over what you're doing, not doing, whatever it might be. And I can certainly look back, and, you know, I've been very honest about this previously in books, or but also on the podcast, talking about the fact that I can see how it's chipped away at me at times, and I can see how it's lessened my confidence in ways. I can certainly see how at times I've even got a bit lost in that and who I am and what I like. Somehow I've managed to not derail too much, and, you know, I've certainly had some hairier moments where I've mentally not felt well, but we've seen it play out time and time again with people that are exposed to, you know, are in the public eye and exposed to that level of commentary at a very young age, and it does play out in devastating ways at times, whether it's you know, all of these things are coping mechanisms, by the way. I'm coming not from a place of judgment here, you know, whether it's drinking, drugs, gambling, whatever it might be, whatever we might see it as destruction, they're all coping mechanisms, because it's not normal to be exposed to all of that at such a young age. But seemingly from the outside, you three have navigated it very well. I mean, I don't know. I don't know you guys personally, but it seems from the outside that you've moved through it with your own sets of values really held firmly and staying true to what you like, which is simply making music. Is that accurate, or have you felt the harsh reality of what it's like to grow up from a very young age in the public eye?
My understanding is that there's a psychological sort of jarring that happens when you become famous. And many, many people are sort of trapped in the personality at the age they were when they become, like, in the spotlight. And so I think that the thing with us is, if people assume, you know, so Umbop came out when I was 12. And so they go, oh, you were 12. But we had made so many choices at that point. I think there was a maturity level on a lot of areas where we had already made the choice of the 25-year-old, of the 35-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
you know, like,
we were
like,
in it, yeah.
You know, and so I think we were lucky that we had a really good sense of self. Everything else you're talking about, I mean, yeah, absolutely. We went through all of that in an amazing amount of ways. But because of that sense of self, like, this is not what makes me who I am. This is not what people's opinion is not going to change my value. It was always an outside force that
you were fighting against. You had this sense of when someone was maybe making a judgment on you or commentating on you in a negative way, or like,
or a way you perceived as
negative.
Like,
they're obviously wrong. Like, mm-hmm. that was the sense about yeah. it. And so,
and that comes from your parents. Where does that come from? Because that's a really, that's an amazing realization to have at a very young age. Certainly one that totally passed me by. You know, I definitely felt defined at times by only commentary and very little by what I knew to be true. So I think it's, I think it's exceptional that you all managed to retain that sense of self. And I can only assume that that comes from family values and how your parents dealt with you at a young age.
It's absolutely our parents. But I mean, I think if we're getting really real, it's faith. I mean, it's
spiritual grounding.
It's a spiritual grounding. It's that Christian faith of understanding, like you were made for a reason. You exist in the world as you are because like there is divine purpose for you. And that's never, our music has never been Christian music, but in the sense of like writing scriptures into our songs. But when you hear a song like Weird, you know, and it's like everybody's weird sometimes, like you, that's coming from this sense of like, but we all have purpose. Like, don't give up on yourself. Look into the world and know that like you're making impacts in a positive way. You have a value here and kind of not really a job to do, but your job is to just be the best version of you, and that will result in where you're supposed to be.
I think the sense of purpose, I mean, speaking about it from the point of view of a divine, you know, view of the world that's deeper than just, hey, you're an accident. Hey, boom, you showed up. You know, the minute you just look at yourself as I'm supposed to be here and there's just one me and that's why I'm here. You know, I'm not just a clone of somebody else. That does change your perspective. And just to think about, you know, starting off young, the strange thing about breaking young is we didn't come out of a factory. You know, we were guys in a garage band that were writing these songs. And so,
and very kind of, in some sense, overly confident and also overly naive all at the same time.
Well, you were kids. You're meant to be.
The saving grace too, of having a sense of purpose, the sense of, you know, I'm not just an accident and, you know, I'm going somewhere in my life, regardless of whether the world sees it or whether I'm quietly in the garage, is that we really came out of this as craftsmen. And the voice that you've heard, you know, when we first broke in with Mbop, like that's a song, you know, that we wrote. It's a song that was our message, you know, and then you have, you know, the continued story for songs like Penny and Me from our record when we launched the independent label. And here we are, and, you know, telling that story. That's still us. And so I think the advantage that we had, frankly, you know, I'd much rather be an artist than, honestly, in your shoes where you're present, you know, you're playing the role of host, you're playing the role of curating culture at the time. That's almost harder because you have to respond to everyone's voice around. You have to be kind of hosting the conversation of whatever's current in the moment. With us, we kind of can say, well, we don't care what's current. This is what we want to say. You know, this is who we are. This is the painting we want to paint. And I think
for
better or for worse. It's, and sometimes what you want to say hits the trend wave and it lines up where you are and where the world is and hits at the right time. A lot of times it doesn't, but the advantage of being able to say, look, I'm an artist, like I need to do this no matter what. I need to do this whether there's 10,000 people or whether there's 10 people. And that sort of says, well, I'm going to be happy with my work one way or another. And it's kind of a win as long as I start with I'm proud of this. And so I think that's a huge, huge defining sort of grounding factor in what's helped, I know for me, survival over time.
Yeah, because I mean, it seems like an amazing, a very strong triangle of sort of, you know, having great family values, the love of music and the identity you hold within that, combined with faith, which I find so interesting. You know, I didn't grow up with any particular doctrine or religion in the household, but my mum has always clung quite tightly to sort of spiritual concepts, sometimes out of her having a tough time mentally and needing to have something else. And it's something I'm deeply interested in. Well, I always have been, but I've really dug deep into it in the last 5 years. I just don't think that I had the, perhaps, I don't know if it was savviness or passion to look within that deeply enough as a kid. And I'm almost jealous that, you know, when you align with a certain religion, you can really work with that and you can and you can work with the belief system there, and you know that it works. Well, you guys are living proof that it works, because you're still doing what you do and you enjoy doing what you do, and you haven't, I don't like using the word derailed, but I can't think of an alternative, but you haven't gone off into these sort of cliches that happen with a lot of kids who grew up in the public eye, because you've stuck with those three things that are intrinsic to who you are and how you'll remain happy within the madness, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's within the madness.
Exactly. I mean, and we're just talking about our family. I mean, that's not even the world. Truthfully, though, I think there is, an advantage to being in a band also, because it is a little bit, there's a song off our last record called Against the World. There's a line that says, it's you and me and us against the world. And it's a song that was kind of directed in some sense at the audience as well as us. But it really talks about the fact that when you're in this unit and you're in this band, it's a little bit like a band of brothers, literally, or in the kind of like military sense.
Figurative sense.
You're in this fight together in a lot of ways. And I do not envy folks like you or other solo artists or other TV presenters or radio hosts or things, because there's a real challenge and a real difficulty in going through life on your own. I don't think we're meant to go through life on our own. If you don't have some constants like that with, bandmates or brothers or things like that, that are kind of, shall we say, holding you together or in some capacity, keeping you on the rails, being like, hey man, don't push too hard. The train might, go off the tracks. It's difficult to stay within a sane version of yourself, because I will say, probably me more than anyone, I am definitely guilty of being the one who feels like he's got a little bit more to prove and a little bit more of a chip on his shoulder about some things, because I try very hard to understand other people and try very hard to kind of empathize with what people are going
that?
Through.
Why do they keep saying that?
And why the idea that people, go, oh, well, you're this and oh, well, you're that. And I feel like, wait, that's not right. I have a tendency to be fairly defensive at times, because, and Taylor and Zach do not have that particular thing in their psyche. They have other problems, huge, massive problems. We could talk about that all podcast long.
So do you guys all play almost a role within this trio to support the work you're doing? Is there somebody that pushes things forward or someone that pulls things back a bit? And what's the dynamic? How does that work?
I would say that our personalities fit fairly well with our instruments. So when you look at a piano, you have 88 keys, and you want to play all the instruments, all the lines at the same time, right? This is very Taylor. The big dream.
It's a composer's instrument.
I'm playing the bass, and I'm playing the high part. I'm playing the chords, right? Lead guitarists are playing off of people. So, Isaac is always playing off of people. That's even in your description of your own challenges, right? You're expressing that you would hear someone say something and play off of that, have a feeling reacting to that. And so, that's sort of the role.
The classic line from Ike in the studio or writing songs, ooh, 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 that's a cool idea. Go there.
Yeah.
ooh.
And I think drummers as a whole, my wife said to me, it's crazy that you have to assemble your instrument every time you go somewhere, right? That's unique to a drummer. You have to put it together like an Erector set. And I think because of that, drummers just, they don't care. They know their job is the most important, whether other people realize that or not. They know the song doesn't start until they start, and it ends whenever they stop playing.
Wow. Right? And it's a foundational thing. And so, it's the foundation of the band.
Therein lie describing his role. He affirms Zach's perspective on his role.
So there's a very, my role is to kind of be the guy that shows up to facilitate what's needed.
It's not so much that you're wrong, it's that you just haven't realized that I'm right.
But what I mean is,
I know people like you.
I'm not a dreamer. For being in a band for years and years and years and doing all this and all the amazing things and places we've gone. And, we were just playing a surprise show at a festival for, there were 70,000 people. You're standing on stage and you're like, what? We're in Mexico playing a show. There's 70,000 people. This is insane. Yeah. Right. But I'm not a dreamer. I'm a doer. Music is like a set of Legos in front of you, and it can be assembled 100 ways, but it's sort of
that's a note and that's a note, and you build it. So it's not a mystery.
Dreamer, doer, and counselor.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting. So I would just add to that. So I mean, everybody's very creative in very different ways. And everything Zach said is right. He's totally controlling. We're all controlling in our own way of what matters to us. I mean, I definitely look at things sort of, if you think about building things, I definitely like to play the architect from the point of view. I want to draw the whole picture. Like I want to know the whole, even if the wing is never built, I want to think about, but that's where the tennis court would be. And that's where and I would say Zach's described, we've described different ways. Ike, to me is actually like is the carpenter. He's the guy who's like carving out the mantle in this beautiful ornate way. And like, he's there and it's beautiful and it's Ike's doing that. That's where he's present, you know? And then Zach to me is the builder. Zach's more like, he's like, let's build the thing. Why are you still designing the wing? Damn it. We know this is a house. It has rooms.
We have a timeline. We have things we've got to do.
It's beautiful. It's fine. It's
1, 2, 3, 4, go.
Yeah, just get on with it.
Why are we still designing a wing? But
isn't a plane. It's a house.
Yeah. You're never going to be able to pay for the tennis court. Stop designing it. But it's the feeling off of each other, and regardless of people's different process. And some days, I mean, interestingly, in those roles, a lot of times you change roles depending on what you're driving. You know, this new project we've done was, I would say, extremely painful for me because it was a detachment of what I have always loved a lot about our records, which is knowing kind of at the beginning, okay, here's the 8 songs and here's the 12 songs, and I know at least like we've all kind of,
there's just too many questions.
And this one, the consensus was everybody's going to take 5 songs and essentially write them and then bring the others in to work on them with a couple other partners that we love and respect. Jim Scott, legendary Jim Scott, producer, mixer, engineer, and then legendary David Garza, writer, artist, producer, anyway. But still, the lack of like, hey, this is how, like, feeling like you can bring everything to bear was painful. But
you couldn't fully be the architect.
Yeah, you had to let go.
Process, I know for everybody in this record, it allowed people to stretch some muscles that they hadn't stretched, and it shifted a certain roles. And Isaac had to say, well, I have to be the taskmaster on this, and Zach had to say, I have to be the dreamer on this, and I had to be the, play off of you in a different way on these things. So, this sense of whatever your role, like your strong in, this is who I am, is you're always having to kind of adjust to get from here to there. You know, it's not like you get to just stay in a fixed position. You have to respond. You have to figure out how to get it done. I mean, and not kill each other.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Being related and having been in a band together for so long, you have to put effort into doing things differently. Otherwise, I'm sure there would be an element where you'd get perhaps not complacent, but you know how this works. This is how we do things. So I think it's interesting with this new project that you've decided to combine these sort of 3, I guess, solo records into one album to test every element of everything that you've just talked about. Because, as much as we all love what we do, you don't want to get bored in it. You don't want to, rest on your laurels and know that you can do things a certain way. So I think it's brilliant that you're doing that. And, I'm deeply interested in how the hell you do all of this combined with family life, because you have multiple children. Taylor obviously wins with 7. And this is not my most well-structured question or well thought out. But how do you parent 7 children? I honestly only just cope with I've got one off school today. He's not even that ill. Like I know he's not. He's pretending. He had to play Nintendo earlier whilst I recorded my radio show because he had nowhere else to go. And it's like, oh my God, this is impossible. So to deal with seven kids, I hats off. I honestly don't know how you do it.
Well, I think, first of all, we're not doing the brunt of the work in a lot of cases. It is our exceptional wives.
Oh, your amazing wives. Tell me about these women, because they're incredible.
Well, they've dedicated their lives to the nurturing and care of the kids that we have together. And, you know, obviously just like each of us are different, our relationships and our wives are obviously very unique to each family kind of structure. But, but the thing that is the same is they're kind of like us when we're on the road, which we haven't been for a couple of years, which actually in some ways has been really cool. But
they're ready to see us.
They're ready to, they do it 24/7, but they're ready to see us.
Yeah. That bye.
So you know, yes, please leave.
How do you, I mean, let's get real. I mean, having kids is essentially an act in selflessness, because children, as amazing and adorable and lovable as they are, they're completely selfish, right? Kids, they're just completely focused on what they want to do, whatever it is. I mean, we're talking about our career. As small children, we thought we're going to be a band and, you know, we're going to travel the world. And our parents were like, oh, my God, I've got to help them do this. You know, and that's the experience every day, right? Whether what kids want is both the best possible thing for them, right? As they're dreaming and they're, I'm going to be an author and here's my story and I'm going to make, you know, and then they just want to eat a whole bucket of ice cream for dinner and
which
breakfast.
Which is not good for them.
No.
And so, I mean, I think.
But it's fantastic.
Is it as hard as you think it is? It's 120% as hard as you think it is. Yeah. But it's just, if that's not your favorite thing to do in the world, you probably shouldn't be a parent, because you're going to spend all of your time worried about them killing themselves.
Yes, the worry, the anxiety.
I mean, like,
God,
put down the scissors, put down the scissors. Oh, my God, no. Oh, God.
And just the anxiety of, like, the world that we live in currently, which we know is in a state of flux in all manner of ways. And I have real anxiety about that. You know, oh, my God, how do we, and, like, the technology element to things. And
oh, my God.
How do we even, we can't protect, like, this is the world they're growing up in. That causes me much angst. I don't know how with that one.
I would just jump in there and add, you know, agree. But, you know, the thing about, for one, large volumes of children is it evolves. You know, Isaac said earlier, the phrase that I've like now believe, like I'm reminded of every day of, you know, the days are long and the years are short. Is really, really gets true as you get longer and longer. And as your kids get older, you'll see this even more. I have a 19-year-old and I have a 1-year-old. And it is so crazy, because I'm looking at my 19-year-old and I'm like, you really were 3, like a minute ago. Yeah. I mean, it is weird. I mean, I was just with my 17-year-old daughter who just turned 17, and, you know, she's talking about
get ready world.
Be a doctor, you know, and you know, Penny's an amazing person and you know, has all the dreams and all the, you know, things, all the crazies that she wants to do, and she'll do it. But it's the thing of being present in where you are, because, you know, when you're like not sleeping at all in the early years where your kids, you know, the little babies, and you're like, I really don't remember what sleep feels like. It does end. It actually, that part does end. I mean, I've seen that end.
It's called touring.
And so it's that thing of like trying to take in what you get, because, you know, one of the things that I feel like really blown away by now is that registering that life feels short, partly because you're not the same person the whole time, right? You're the kid version of yourself, you're the teen version of yourself, you're the young adult, then you're the parent, hopefully, then you're eventually grandparent and blah, blah, blah. And like you get these little windows, like where you're in that role for a while. And to me, that's kind of where the magic sauce is realizing that wherever you are, it's just a window of time. Like, it's going to evolve. And so you can either be really frustrated and like crazy about it, or you can realize it's going to evolve. And all of a sudden, you're going to be in the next role. And I've seen that now, like crazy vividly, because of that many kids. And you keep evolving forward. Yes, you're more tired. But
tired.
I think we're also at a point.
so tired.
Yeah, so tired.
So tired. Well,
so you know. It's
mental exhaustion ending. Is a real thing. Yeah.
We don't have, you know, and outside of you know, everyone has their different dynamic. I mean, you know, my dynamic with my wife is very different than Isaac's with his, and Taylor's with his. But ultimately, I mean, as dads, we didn't actually make these children. And so we don't take on the role. No. I mean, like every cell in the body is made by the mom.
Yeah, like, that's true.
And there's a connection and a burden and a beautiful thing that you don't quite get to participate in as a dad, because ultimately they're yours, like on loan from mom. You know, they're yours on loan from mom.
And then eventually your wife is like, seriously, take them. No, I mean,
yeah, take all of them.
It's a partnership though. It's a huge partnership. I mean, though,
it is, but we're the offensive line and mom is the quarterback. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
so true.
Like our job is to protect her and to take care of her. And without us, mom's in trouble. She's getting sacked all the time. Sorry, I'm using American football.
Yeah, but I don't know anything about, you know, any under football, attack. Yeah. British or American, but I get the analogy. I'm with you on it. Yeah. And so let's talk about, you know, I should have talked about this earlier when we were discussing sort of growing up in the industry, but I've pondered this a lot personally, and I wonder, well, actually, I know the answer to it. Looking at my own life, if I had been doing the job I was doing back in the day and there had been the prevalence of social media that we're experiencing today, I don't know if I could have stuck it out. I don't know if I could have dealt with that, which is a whole extra layer of everything. It's, you know, it's impossible to unpick the whole thing. Constant and noisy and full of comparison. And you know, we were all very lucky in terms of, you know, starting our careers in the 90s. And that was not a thing. There was the level of commentary that obviously we've gotten used to, but that ubiquitous nature of it that all kids are dealing with today, you know, no matter if they're in the public eye or not, every kid is dealing with that element of, yeah, just relentless information they're having to imbibe and process. I don't think I would still be in the job today. And I wonder, what are your feelings about that? How do you think you would have coped personally? How do you deal with it with your own children today?
Well, I mean, I guess, well, again, I mean, each of us are different.
I'm the laggard over here. My son, who's 15, only just got a cell phone.
Oh, that's amazing. Well done, you.
I know there are a lot of folks that probably couldn't do that or wouldn't feel comfortable with that, but he only just got one. And so it is possible to do that. One of the things I will say, though, I think we should all strongly consider the idea that social media is not a good idea for young people. Like, real, I mean, very seriously, like there's a great social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt who talks about this.
No
a lot.
Social media before 18.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, or at least 16. I mean, you know, like it's just too. I
think the opposite. I think the adults need to turn it off because they're the.
Yeah, it's affecting. I do think it's affecting everybody. It is, for sure. I think it's kids and adults. It's not great for our brains.
You guys, what do you mean? Anti-social media?
Yeah.
Yeah, actual socializing in real life with actual humans.
There you go.
You know, this probably, I think, all goes back to that sense of self and that sense of value. And I think the only issue with social media is that we have decided that it has some bearing on our value in the world, that we have made our economic value associated with it, our social value associated with it. It's a game. And some people are good at it and some people are bad at it. If I went out and played a game of baseball, I know I'm bad at baseball. I don't care how I do. I'm doing it for the exercise and the sun and the fun, right?
Yeah.
And I think if people would approach social media that way, it would be what it is, which is just
a sport of opinion game.
It's just a big game, guys.
It's actually like the politicization in a weird way of like entire human
existence
in a way. And I mean that in the sense that by nature of debate and politics, like it gets, because that's the only sport I can think of that is about the kind of like, you know, discussing and
fighting. It's an amazing idea, right? That we have somebody, let's say random artist has 1 million followers, right? And the comment section is on. And that means that somebody with no followers can get access to 1 million people by being the first person to comment. This is an insane idea. This is an insane idea. People with toxic ideas that would never have anyone care what they think, or, you know, that respond aggressively or violently, verbally, like they get to comment and be the first person and have access to
everyone.
Yeah, right. It seems like it's, you know, there's obviously
this is an insane idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that sort of analogy that it's a little bit like having road rage, where you dehumanize the person in the next car and you don't really care what the consequences are because you're about to drive off. And, you know, I was listening to one of Russell Brand's podcast this morning when I was on a walk, and I can't think of the chap he was interviewing, but anyway, they were sort of discussing this, and actually they brought faith into the equation in the sense that, you know, when you look at religions prior to the modern age, there was, you know, there's, we could sit there and argue the wrongs and rights of everything all day, but the premise being that there was an understanding that there was common decency, and that the aim was to be kind, and that the aim was to be a decent person, a helpful person, etc. I know it's way more complicated than that, and there's nuance to that that some don't agree with, whatever, but I'm talking about the general premise being within most religions that the aim was to show decency and to be a kind, good person. And it seems like, you know, I enjoy parts of social media. I'm not here to completely slag it off. There's parts of it that are, I do find fun and that I do find connective. But where it's become just magnified and warped is where all decency is just wiped off the face of the planet. Like, you don't have to have it. Like, come over into this space. You can say whatever you want. We're going to call it freedom of speech. Go. And it's where everything gets muddled and warped. And, you know, I think it's as dangerous for adults as it is for kids, potentially. But it is, I think you're right, Zach, in the fact that we need to just see it as a fun game.
Part of what I think that we're talking about, or the challenge, would be figuring out how to actually say things that are about something versus just saying them to say them. I mean, because if you think about it, if you, like the guy that built the million followers, at the very least, they did a funny dance to probably get a million, you know, I say, you know, but the idea is like, if you're just chasing, you know, I'm the loudest squeaky wheel, like that's pretty much just a black hole. Like, you figuring out how to, I mean, the greatest gift that I feel like I've been given from our time is we learning how to try and get really good at something early in life. And the thing about that is, if you try and actually get really good at anything, like anything, I'm going to be a good reader, I'm going to be a good runner, I'm going to be a good musician, you see what you're made of. And the problem with so much of these things is the access is so low that you can become sort of, you can build a reputation based on almost no talent. You know, and that to me, that's the scariest thing about the world we're in, is how much can be done by simply yelling or screaming or not having an idea, versus like, hey, I have this idea, like better mousetrap, cooler car. What about a hat that fits better? Like, if you could just channel the possibilities, like that's incredible. But it's the noise where, you know, you worked really hard to succeed doing what you do as far as jumping out there.
I think actually, no, those people are really good, because the game they're playing is get a reaction.
Yeah.
And in a world where, in social media, the game is get a reaction. It's not get followers. It's not be the best at something. It's how do I get a reaction? How do I get the algorithm to react to me? And that can be negative reaction, positive reaction.
But that's not getting good at anything that's redeemable.
No.
I didn't say it was.
But it's so strange, because it's also...
Anyway, that's what I'm saying.
Don't you think it's also, you know, incrementally, lots of things for us have changed culturally and cognitively that we're sort of only realising now. One of them is that it's almost a crime to not have an opinion on something. And sometimes when there is, you know, something that's very noisy on social media or even in the news or whatever it is going on, sometimes I think I genuinely don't have an opinion, because I genuinely don't feel like, either I don't know who these people are, so I don't know their backstory and I don't know who's wrong or right or whatever, or I just don't know enough about it. But it's almost a crime to say that out loud, that you don't have an opinion. And, you know, then if you think about, we had an amazing Buddhist monk on the podcast a while back, who's since sadly passed away, but his whole mantra was, I may be wrong, you know, and the humbling thought that we don't know anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
We literally don't know anything. But that beautiful theory that is seeped into very sort of esoteric thinking has become like the worst thing possible, that you don't have commentary on something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah, bravo. Stop commenting, everyone.
We just finished a song that'll come out to our fan club this year. It's called Strange World. And one of the lines in the song says, so much that we know for sure is just what we comprehend, right? It's a strange world. I think you're so right. And just as an exercise, everyone should figure out some, I don't know if it's an amount of time or amount of days or amount of words you've read on the topic, but just sort of refrain and just go, what do I really know? How many people have I asked? Before you weigh in, I mean, if it's the Oscars or something like that, maybe you can make a comment. But when you're talking about really important things, social issues, movements, these things that have real weight, and there are people who really are defining themselves by the results of these things, mm-hmm. we should take a minute and go, is it time for me to make a comment? Do I have a place in this conversation yet? Not everyone has a place because the world's, you know, events affect you. But is it time for me to speak? Like, has the conch come to me? Is it my turn?
Yeah. I mean, I'm reminded of some stuff that, you know, our dad would often say when we were young kids. And I promise this relates, which is that, you know, when we're in these environments where there's a lot of folks and, you know, you're especially in the very beginning as this first record is blowing up and even second record, all these kind of things. And throughout our lives, our dad would constantly remind us, hey, look, you may only meet this person one time in your life. So treat them with that knowledge that this may be the only impression you make on this person ever, right? And so do your best to be present with that person as much as possible and to reflect who you want to be and who you believe that you can be, even if you're tired, even if it's the 1,000th time, the 10,000th time, even if you're at dinner with your friends or whatever, remember, this may be the only moment. And then to broaden that thought, I think we're all at war with ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
We're all at war with our own selves. And the great kind of fight that we're fighting is against self-righteousness and ego.
Ego. Okay? It's the old ego. It's behind everything.
And it is. And it is. And it is the enemy within our own souls and hearts. And the terrifying thing about what we're talking about right now with regard to social media is it is like gasoline on the ego. And because it inspires you as the naive and self-righteous person that you inevitably are, all of us find ourselves in that place, right? To respond like a reflex. You know, the person hit your knee with the rubber hammer and you went ding! And you didn't even think. It inspires you to do things without thinking. If you're not careful, you just fall into that trap constantly. And then you become the worst version of yourself, not the best version of yourself, which hopefully the best version of yourself is to go so far as to treat others the way you want to be treated. And even, shall I say, so extremely love those who do not love you.
Yeah, I guess it's like
love your enemy. Like
goes yourself. Back to that lovely decency we've talked about, being decent rather than right, like thinking that you're right, you know? I love it. I think that's it's the whole sort of conversation around being a decent human is undervalued in the modern world and one that I really love having. So I know you're very busy. You're about to go on tour. Where's the first stop of your world tour, by the way?
First stop is Helsinki.
Nice.
Coming across Europe and be in the UK in June. And then we're all making up for lost time. All the musicians that have during the pandemic been essentially, you know, stationary.
Grounded.
So we'll be in, you know, 90 or so cities across the world. And summertime, July, August, September, we'll be back in the US. And just busy.
Amazing, busy. Amazing. Well, look, I wish you all the luck with your red, green and blue. I think I got that in the right order, tour. I wish you all the best with it. And it's been lovely catching up with you today. Thank you so much for chatting.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for your time.
Oh, that was fun. What brilliant people. I loved talking to Isaac, Zach and Taylor. Just wonderful. Thank you for the laughter, guys, and the thoughtfulness too. Hanson's new album, Red, Green, Blue, is out on the 20th of May. And as you just heard, they're going on tour this summer. They're going to be doing some pretty special shows all over the world. I'll be back next week with another insightful chap. So make sure you're following Happy Place on your podcast feed to be the first to know about that episode. And you can follow us on Instagram too if you like. We're over at Happy Place Official. Until then, a massive thank you again to Hanson, to the producer Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you gorgeous lot. Thank you for listening. I love you dearly, and we'll speak very soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.